But to begin this evening, the sound there of the dredging crew celebrating the successful Suez refloating operation earlier this week. The container ship, the Ever Given, was freed on Monday after running aground in high winds and spending 6 days diagonally wedged in the Suez Canal. This event highlighted the waterway's importance to global supply chains. It brought a major portion of the world's seaborne trade to a standstill as hundreds of ships were either stuck in traffic or forced to reroute. Since it was completed in 1869, the Suez Canal has been one of the world's most important bodies of water, a portal between East and West, vital to global trade. Some called last week's incident the new Suez Crisis, but it was nothing compared to the original Suez Crisis in 1956, when Britain, France and Israel invaded Egypt to fight for control of the canal. To talk about this, I'm joined now by Dr. Hussein Omar, lecturer in modern global history at University College Dublin. Hussein, you're very welcome to the History Show.
Thank you.
Now, the crisis was sparked when President of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, nationalized the canal. Tell us a little bit about Nasser, a kind of legendary figure in global history, and his rise to power in Egypt.
So Nasser was the humble son of a postman. He's born in 1918, towards the end of the First World War. He's named Jamal after Jamal Pasha, the commander of the Ottoman army at the time. And he is by all means very bright. He ends up in law school and he gets politicized in the 1930s when the very short-lived Egyptian democratic constitution is suspended under pressure from the occupying British forces. And he participates in a demonstration. He gets wounded. He spends a night in jail. And he's basically infuriated by the continued occupation of Egypt by Britain. And the continued occupation is after 1922, when Egypt is nominally given independence, centered around the Suez Canal itself, which the British had refused to cede control over. The Suez Canal is the reason, in some ways, that Britain occupies Egypt in the first place in 1882. Nasser is a law student in 1936, at the moment when the Anglo-Egyptian treaty is renegotiated, and it's seen by elite politicians as an attempt to give Egypt more freedom than it had previously been granted, but it doesn't go far enough for young men like Nasser. However, the Anglo-Egyptian treaty allows Egyptians to enroll in the military academy for the first time since the 1880s, something that had really been prohibited by Britain. So Nasser leaves law school and he joins the military academy, energized, radicalized. He may or may not have been a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization which emerges around the Suez Canal, very much in opposition to the continued colonization of Egypt. He also joins forces with a group called Young Egypt, a group of quasi-fascist leanings that understood that making an alliance with Germany against Britain might be beneficial to Egypt's interests, a story that is, of course, familiar here in Ireland. Nasser is part of a group of military officers that after an accelerating amount of tension between Britain and Egypt in 1952, launch a coup to depose the king of Egypt. And they do so by taking over the radio and simply making an announcement that he was deposed. And it comes off the back of a bloody event in which quite a lot of Egyptian police officers are killed by British gunfire in January of 1952, January 25th, which is then declared Police Day, which is also the day that was chosen for the start of the protests in 2011, which are protests against the Egyptian police. In 1952, Nasser is very much in the background. He's not yet in the lead. The man leading the revolution, as it were, is a more senior military figure called Mohammed Naguib. But Nasser has every intention of overthrowing Naguib, which he's plotting to do behind the scenes. There's an attempt on Nasser's life in 1954 by the Muslim Brotherhood, which he then uses as an excuse to quash all dissent and to come to power. So in 1956, when he nationalizes the canal, Nasser is part an emerging constellation of forces that are competing for power, and arguably it is through the nationalization of the canal that Nasser secures his place as the leading figure of Egyptian, Arab, and indeed third world politics in the mid-1950s.
Now, 1956, we're very much in the middle of the Cold War, but Nasser is somebody who, on the face of it at least, espouses non-alignment, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. There are all sorts of rumors, however, that the Free Officers, of which Nasser was a part, was a kind of CIA-sponsored operation. And indeed, it's really in the beginning of the 1950s, it's unclear which way Egypt will go. The USSR at this point is supportive of Israel, which was established in 1948. France is the leading exporter of arms to Israel. The United States and Egypt have a closer relationship at that point than you might think. The lines aren't really set. The US has offered at this point to give Egypt a loan via the World Bank to build a dam in Aswan, the southernmost town in Egypt on the Nile, which would, on the one hand, provide Egypt with hydropower, but would also regulate the flooding of the Nile, which was really essential to Egypt's agricultural economy. There is a back channel attempt by the Americans to forge some kind of peace between Israel and Egypt in 1955. Egypt says they are willing to, or Nasser says he is willing to, provided that the U.S. supply him with unlimited arms, something that they are unwilling to do. And it's the kind of the fallout from these failed negotiations in 1955 that leads Nasser to think that if he is unable to secure a loan via the World Bank, that he has to nationalize the Suez Canal in order to be able to divert the income from the canal to the building of the dam, which is already underway. Meanwhile, Nasser is also buying arms from the USSR via Czechoslovakia, and that allows him to maintain the fiction of non-alignment, which, as time goes on, will appear to be increasingly a fiction.
So is the motivation then for nationalizing the Suez Canal primarily economic, or is it political?
Well, it's both. So as I said, the Suez Canal is both a symbol and the real material reason that Egypt gets incorporated into the British Empire by illegal occupation in 1882. It's when Egypt defaults on a set of loans that Britain uses that as a loans that had been taken in order to pay for the canal, that Britain uses as an excuse to occupy Egypt. So until there is a total evacuation of British troops from the canal zone, Egypt cannot be considered to be sovereign. So there is that. The building of the canal comes at an enormous cost. In, I think, one of the most recent estimates, it says up to 1 million Egyptian men were conscripted into the labor corps that built the canal, and I think casualties have been estimated to be as many as 100,000. So Egypt feels like it's built the canal in blood, paid for it in blood, and yet isn't able to get the revenue from the canal. The occupation of Egypt was both economic and political, and the two cannot actually be separated, either in the history of the colonization of Egypt. The financialization of the British Empire really kind of reaches its zenith in Egypt as this new kind of experimental colonial space, and in the attempt to reclaim sovereignty through taking back the canal, as it were.
And then what's the political and military response immediately to Nasser's nationalization of the canal?
So Nasser's nationalization of the canal is done in code. In a famous speech that is aired on the radio, he utters the words Ferdinand de Lesseps, which is the name of the engineer who built the canal. He is the first cousin of the Empress Eugenie, the wife of Napoleon III. He had been there had been an enormous statue of him in the canal zone, which is subsequently brought down very violently. Again, a theme that is familiar to us thinking about memorialization today. And the uttering of the word Ferdinand de Lesseps is the code for the Egyptian military to move in on the canal zone. Nasser had restricted access to the canal prior to that by closing the Straits of Senefir, which are further south to the canal. So it's where the kind of southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula is. So he effectively blocks off the Red Sea opening of the canal to Israeli ships, therefore preventing them from getting any Red Sea access via their port in Eilat. So he'd done that in 1950. It was understood to be in contravention of the Constantinople Treaty of 1888, which gave the right of passage to ships of all nationalities, regardless of political alignment. Now, he had blockaded the passage of Israeli ships on the grounds that they didn't recognize Israel and therefore didn't recognize Israeli nationality in the first place, and therefore they weren't, in fact, in contravention of the treaty. However, it is interpreted by Israel, by Britain and France as a contravention of the terms of the treaty, all of which launch a counterattack, and soldiers are literally parachuted in by the tripartite aggression, as the three are known in Egyptian historiography. Britain, of course, already had its troops there, whereas the French and the Israelis had to be brought in. The confrontation escalates, and it is, in fact, the U.S. that intervenes in the end to put an end to it.
There's a personal angle from your point of view, because you might not be here were it not for the Suez Crisis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So my grandmother was studying child psychology in Geneva, and my grandfather was studying cardiology in Edinburgh. And they had both left Egypt just after 1952, after the coup, because it was understood that the kind of class that they came from was under threat by Nasser. So part of what Nasser's program was about, aside from his kind of international project, was also a project of social reform in Egypt, and particularly of land reform. And both of my grandparents came from land-owning families, felt threatened somewhat by the coup, although they had a very ambivalent relationship to Nasserism. My great-grandfather, my grandmother's father, was Prince Regent in 1952. So he was brought into power by the free officers to be regent alongside two others over the infant child king before Egypt was declared a republic. So he was in some ways sympathetic to the republican tendencies of the free officers, and yet they weren't sure about how things would play out. So they sent their children off abroad. Now, both of my grandparents, and I think this is testimony to the popularity of the nationalization of the canal, the people who felt very ambivalent about Nasser from the start, returned in great numbers to volunteer in the war effort. And both of my grandparents met. They met as volunteers. He was running one of the military hospitals. She was a nurse. And she telephoned a few days after meeting him. She telephoned her mother. His surname meant lion in Arabic. And because the phones were tapped, she said, "I've met a lion and I'm going to marry him." And indeed, after the crisis ended, they married in early 1957. And yeah, so I am the consequence, or a consequence, of the Suez Crisis.
And how did the Suez Crisis, militarily, how did it end?
It was called off by the Americans. It was seen as humiliating for Britain to have been involved in something that looked like an anachronism. The Age of Empire was supposed to be over, and yet here was Britain behaving in this kind of anachronistic way. And however, in order to reopen the canal, so the canal is closed for roughly close to a year after the crisis into 57. However, in order to reopen the canal, UNF1, which is the UN volunteer force, is deployed to the Sinai, which is declared as a buffer zone. And it's the first time that the UN volunteers are deployed anywhere. And of course, this is subsequently becomes important in Irish history. But this is the first moment in which the UN peacekeeping forces are deployed anywhere. They are mostly Norwegians at that point. And they declare the canal a buffer zone. Now, from the perspective of Egypt, because they're occupying the Sinai, i.e. one side of the canal, this isn't seen as a fair buffer zone by Egypt because it basically occupies a very large portion of its territory and doesn't allow its control over that very central waterway. So it's the eviction of UNF1 later in the 60s, which ultimately then leads to the Six-Day War.
So in terms of British humiliation over Suez, and there's no doubt about it, it was a humiliating moment for empire. The British had long since been kicked out of Ireland. They had a decade beforehand been kicked out of India. Now they're kicked out of Suez. What impact, if any, did that have on then what happens with British colonies in Africa? Because one by one, these colonies are freed. Or would that have happened anyway?
I mean, it's certainly a very dramatic moment. And I think one of the things that I have always found very striking, of course, I mean, the next big moment happens in Aden in 1960. But of course, you're right. I mean, Mau Mau, et cetera. One of the things that I find so striking is the extent to which 1956 seems to be a turning point in the intellectual life of Britain itself, in the sense that so many central thinkers of Britain, whether on the left or on the right, talk about Suez as being a real turning point. So I suppose my answer to that question is my sense was always that Suez was obviously very important for Egypt, but was also very important for Britain. It really reshapes the Britain that comes afterwards. Whether decolonization was by 56 inevitable or not is hard to answer, but there's no doubt that the Suez crisis accelerated what was a process that was underway and did so in very spectacular terms.
Well, my guest was Dr. Hossein Omar, lecturer in modern global history at University College Dublin. Hossein, thank you very much indeed for talking to us about the Suez crisis on the History Show.
Thank you.